Walls of stone will stand upstream to the west to hold back Wushan's clouds and rain till a smooth lake rises in the narrow gorges. That was Mao Zedong's vision of a dam on the Yangtze River way back in 1956. A half century later, the Yangtze was dammed by the Mammoth Three Gorges Project, a monument to China's economic prowess. In the process, archaeological sites were flooded and over a million people displaced. In her new novel, In the Lap of the Gods, Li Miao-Lovett looks at some of these lives changed forever as the waters rise. A poor man is reduced to scavenging the homes of those who abandon towns like Wushan. A young mother leaves her family and journeys to the big city to make a living as a waitress. A rich man finds himself as a power broker in the David and Goliath struggle between the government and the villagers who are losing their homes. These are just some of the characters in the novel, and she joins us to talk about the book. Li Miao-Lovett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
Now, the Three Gorges Project was this humongous project, but it was politically very sensitive for the Chinese government. It got a lot of bad press around about the environmental impact and things like that. How difficult was it for you to research the lives of ordinary people and how they were affected by the dam?
Well, for a period of time, there was a lot of press in the Western papers and magazines. And so there was this wealth of material that I could draw from. And oftentimes these articles have sort of a narrative arc. So they start with somebody who is a poor farmer, usually a farmer. And I had this material that I could turn to. And then at a certain point, it was like a flood that passed. The press dried up. And you know, with fiction, I had a story to tell that was of my own making, although the backdrop of this was all real. So I pieced together things, and my characters came in part out of my imagination and in part out of these collective true stories. I then had the chance to go visit at the end of 2005. And that was when I really got to see for myself, in the midst of writing this book, what was happening to the landscape, what was happening to all these people who had to make new lives in their own country. It was, in essence, being a refugee. You know, the people I talked to had to almost flee the rising waters, as my main character does in the opening scenes. Because if they didn't have anything better to go to, they were forced, in essence, to give up their land, their livelihood, and move to farmland that was less fertile, to places far away in China where they couldn't even speak the dialect, where they could probably not make a living in a viable way.
So what kind of stories did they tell you that really stuck with you and in some ways, you know, made their way into this book?
One of the places I visited was Chengdu. And this had the sort of fame in ancient Chinese lore of being a ghost town where all the souls of the world would journey through on their way to the next world. And the irony is that this indeed became a ghost town during that time when the Yangtze Reservoir was rising to the next level, 256 meters. And I had hoped to go and find these stragglers who were protesting, who said, hey, we cannot afford the rents across the river in the new town, and you know, we're too old or too poor to move. And instead, what I found was a town on its last legs, reduced to rubble across this entire city of about 70,000 people. And I had the chance, since I had hired a taxi driver to take me there, to talk to some of these stragglers. And really, the only people who were in town were the demolition workers. And they were hacking away, chipping away at about half a dozen remaining buildings, trying to salvage all the valuable parts. And there were some farmers as well. And unfortunately, some of them just spoke such a thick accent that you know, I, with my fluent Mandarin, could barely understand them. But what I could make out with, you know, some gesticulations and some explanation from the driver was how there was a farmer who had lost his land because the government seized it. And he had nothing else to turn to. And here he is in this land of desolation that in a few months' time, this is January 1st of 2006, in a few months' time would be completely underwater. And where would he go? And what would his, you know, family do? These were all the questions that are really hard to answer.
Well, I wanted to have you read a little bit from the book, and I thought this would be a good point to hear because you are really documenting the last days of the town of Wushan. So if you could read a section.
In the last days of Wushan, the remaining residents shuffled about in a frenzy of activity. Men carried 2x4s and wooden suitcases stacked up and tied to their shoulder poles. Women scudded along with overstuffed bags, dragging their young children behind them. Lu bumped into a grandmother carrying a baby in the deep wicker basket strapped to her back. She seemed to be the only person moving with a slow gait, and Lu noticed a pensive look in her eyes. When he asked her where they were relocating, she merely replied, "Far away." She blinked and then stared at him with her tired, sunken eyes. "I would rather die and be buried here, but this will be a town of ghosts." On the prescribed day, the residents of Old Wushan climbed to vantage points all around the city to witness the final demolition. Lu found a spot on the hill leading up to New Wushan. It was a hazy day, and only the sound of cicadas chirping broke the stillness. All eyes in New Wushan were turned toward the abandoned city. Old Wushan had a lawless, soulless element, and not many seemed sorry to let it go. In its last days, it was as good as the skeleton of a fish, stripped of its flesh and hardened gills, all of which had been scoured and picked clean despite the rot within. Just then, a few boys darted down the hill, sending up dust and scaring lizards into the brush. The youngest walked up to Lu. "Hey, mister, what you doing?" Lu removed his cigarette and exhaled, "Waiting for the fireworks." Moments later, a great explosion rocked the hillside. The old city trembled, and then it began to tumble to the earth. Tall buildings tottered and fell like drunken men. Shells of low-rises crumbled and turned to dust. The resounding roar flushed birds out of the cemetery's trees. The raucous cries drowned in the din of dynamite that shook the entire valley. Smoke rose from the city in torpid black clouds as explosion after explosion went off. Old Wushan had become a ship tossed at sea, and when the storm subsided, the city would sink into a remorseless, watery grave. The boys hooped and cheered as they watched the destruction. Lu puffed away on his cigarette, watching the rivulets of smoke trail out toward the valley of dark clouds below. He had little to lose, but an empty feeling gnawed at his stomach, although he had just eaten. He thought of the old woman's words. He thought of Fei Fei and their home in Fengzhe. And when he could no longer stand the emptiness, he got up and made his way back to New Wushan.
Thank you. That's Li Miao Lovett reading from her new novel, In the Lap of the Gods. I thought it fascinating that, you know, there's this old Wushan and the government is creating this new Wushan that everybody has to move to. And that the fact that it's called the New Wushan, and it's, is it like just erase the old Wushan and let's forget about it and not think about it anymore? This Wushan will just cease to exist?
So that was the intention handed from up high. And when I was there for the first time in 2006, New Wushan was built literally above, on the slopes above Old Wushan, with these amazing, you know, 100 steps that descended down the main several streets of the city. Old Wushan was still around, and I would go down to the site where you could overlook an old cemetery with beautiful trees, and there were some old buildings remaining, and people were scavenging the doors and the piping and, you know, carrying these doors stacked up on their backs, you know, and just, putting them in piles at the top of the hill. There were encampments on the hillside of people who could not afford to move to the new town. And they just had fires going all day and crops planted all around. So people were clinging to this old way of life. And in New Wushan, you would find this funny juxtaposition that you see in a lot of cities in China. There's the skyscrapers and, you know, all those elements of modern China with these alleyways tucked in between where people sold goods and, you know, hot pot and fresh vegetables and you know they had their stands where they acted as if this brand new modern China did not exist inside these little alleyways. So you see the old and the new.
Your character Liu, who you talk about, who is watching the destruction of Wushan, is in fact one of these scavengers. He's making his living by going to these abandoned town and seeing what people left behind. And in the course, he finds a little baby girl that somebody had abandoned. Had you heard stories like that, that people actually abandoned not just doors and gold, but even little children?
What inspired me to write in the character of Little Rose, the baby girl who's abandoned, was coming across a newspaper clipping, and it was some AP story about a busload of babies that had been found on a mountain highway in China. And it was making its way to the city and clearly to an orphanage. And you kind of think, you know, who was taking those babies there? How much were they going to fetch for those babies? And what kind of, you know, underground market was there that we're not even aware of in the West? And that really prompted me to think about the value of a human being. And it made me realize, in talking to my father just very recently, he came back from a trip to China for the first time in 60 years. He went back to visit his homeland that he had to flee in 1949. And the way that he described, you know, the travails of wartime made me think about how human life is not valued the same way that we think of it in the West. And it's not always easy for us to put a judgment on what people do. And yet, this little article, this clipping, made me think about what it meant to survive and what those circumstances might do to a family's decision.
Well, it's not just poverty, because you also have the other major character in the book, Fang, who is a relatively wealthier man who tries to act in a way as this power broker between the new China and the people left behind by the new China. He's the one who greases palms and tries to organize deals. Where did the inspiration of that character come from?
In the story, I guess by nature of stories, I needed somebody who would kind of have that villainous side. And yet I didn't want to...
But he's a sympathetic villain.
In the end, he does become that. I could have left him very sort of just one-sided. And yet I realized there's a story to Fang, as there is a story to this ruthless and greedy part of China, that I want to tell, that there is the possibility of turning over a leaf. And the outcome is not perfect by any means, of him making a decision in the end to help these peasants in a village that will eventually be drowned by another large dam project.
Fang, the character, wants to help these peasants who are trying to stand up to the might of the state. And without giving anything away as to what exactly happens, let's just say the novel is fairly realistic. You know, even though it's fiction, you don't get carried away by the possibility of fiction. But there's a line in the book where you say, "And the peasants stood as tiny twigs in the path of the tidal wave of change." Is there any hope for these Davids in the David and Goliath struggle in China?
I think it really depends. I heard the Dalai Lama speak recently, and he was asked to make a prognosis about where China was going, you know, vis-a-vis Tibet. And it is really hard to know if the communist government in power will try to return to its roots of standing up for the poor peasants. At least those were the slogans they carried into China, you know, at the outset of the birth of the communist government. The people of my father's generation who had to flee have been disappointed by that promise. The new China is a funny mix of incredible freedom in a capitalist sense, but serious repression in other aspects. And unfortunately, it is the poor, you know, it's the poor, it's often the peasants who are left behind, and they don't have a voice. There is not really the rule of law, despite what might be, you know, in their books, to defend with lawyers, to defend with, you know, real policy changes. What is happening to, you know, the poor people who are still living off the land? And often in the case of this area of China, Chongqing, a major city of 30 million, having to move to urban areas where they have to literally scrounge. So my experience of going to these places was being surrounded by, they're called bangbang men. So they have these bamboo poles, and they will offer to carry anything, you know, enormous boxes, your luggage. They're all trying to make a living in a country where, you know, there's fabulous wealth, but only for a very select few at the top.
And in fact, it struck me that one of the sentences in the book which really resonated was there's this line where they're talking about one of the characters and says, "She has never eaten bitterness, not like us old folks." And that felt like a really important line in the book, this notion of eating bitterness and a certain resignation among the part of the people who are watching this change happen around them and know that the dam will happen and the waters will rise, whether they oppose it or not.
There's certainly something in the Chinese culture about accepting fate. And then at the same time, there's the belief that with effort and with education and with some luck, you can rise above your circumstances. I think there's been, you know, an acceptance, of course, that, you know, here we have this dam project. We can't really do anything to, you know, move the waters, to move the mountains of the government. At the same time, there have been specific localities or communities where protests and even protests leading to violence, to repressive crackdowns by the government, have risen, you know, in opposition because the people literally have nowhere to go. They have no recourse. And the parallel story in my book is actually based on one of these places. And that part I wanted to fictionalize. I changed the names of the villages and the river, and in essence to protect that particular community of people who are seriously being affected. And even about a year ago, I was reading about yet another round of protests where the villagers were refusing access, for the officials were trying to come in and clear them out, since the reservoir was going to be rising in the coming months with this dam project. Also in the same area in Sichuan province, and people were, you know, there were several villagers who would take their natural gas canisters and cradle them, go up to the roof and refuse to leave, you know, and protest to blow themselves up. And it's an ironic form of self-immolation or, you know, you wouldn't call it terrorism per se, but the desperation that, you know, drives people to stand up to the government. In 2006, a number was floating around from the official reports of the government that there were 90,000 protests in China. And this was not just, you know, five people kind of waving a sign. These were serious protests against, you know, government and industry imposition, mostly for urban development and for dam building.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much, Sandeep.
Li Miao-Lovett is the author of In the Lap of the Gods.